Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
Hey, Jay. Jay, it's Dave here.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, you ready for our little weekly podcast?
I am indeed.
Are you? Well, then let's begin, because I'm recording.
Fantastic.
Cool. So how's your week been?
Busy week, finishing up semesters here, and there's parents pulling up to load their kids' stuff into the car and drive home.
Really? So is that an exciting time for you? Do you have a big summer plan?
I live right next to one of NYU's dorms, and so I see the dramas every year of the freshmen being dropped off by the parents, you know, and then the pickups, and it's a wonderful thing to see, actually, the seasons of the academic year with the families and just getting a sense of people's lives. Anyway,
you know, I don't even, actually, before we move on, do you teach undergrads or graduate students?
Both.
Both? Interesting. So, okay, I was just curious, because I really didn't know very much about what you do. So,
here's my agenda for tonight's call. I want to hear about Ted Nelson. I'm very into that.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk about your Twitter projects, meaning the 100 top followed or
sure
one, you could do that. And I think we should talk a little bit about paying for news, something we haven't really discussed on our podcast, because the Wall Street Journal tonight announced that it's going to go with a micropayments and subscription, premium subscription.
Yeah, I just saw you posted something about
that. Yeah, so I'd love to know, like, what you think about it. I'd like to sort out what I think about it. That would be pretty cool.
Go for it. Let's start with that, then.
Okay, well, the news isn't really very detailed, but it does seem to signal that they're going to try some sort of system where you pay by the article for some things, mm-hmm. and then for a class of material, which they haven't told us anything about, there'll be a premium subscription, and so you can pay for that, and it'll be probably like a tiered subscription thing. But anyway, that's all we know. It's like an intention, but it's a little bit more than just we're planning to charge, because what they're saying is they're actually going to try and develop this idea of pay per
mm-hmm.
unit of journalism, right? Which
right.
is what an article-based system is. So so that's what they said. And, of course, this takes place within a much larger debate, as it were, about charging, and quite a lot of journalists now convinced that they should charge. Not all of them are familiar with previous attempts to do that or the difficulty of doing that, and that's part of it. But Murdoch himself has recently made it very clear that this is something he's going to do, so it's not entirely unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think was interesting to me for our podcast is simply I would love to know how you think about this whole puzzle. I can give you a sort of short sketch of how I approach it, which is that I don't have a religion about charging.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think it's bad, and I don't necessarily think it's good either. I think it should be approached as a practical problem, not as sort of a theology.
Correct. I'm with you 100%.
Yeah.
I think we tend to agree on things like this. I'm a very sort of, like, I don't, laissez-faire, I don't care. I mean, whatever works for you is great. If that works for them, fantastic.
I sort of have that attitude. I do think that there are different public benefits that come with different forms of journalism, and pricing is one of those different.
Well, mm-hmm.
and that's important to factor
but
in.
But there are two questions. Let me just throw this out. There are two questions that every one of us has to answer, okay? Which is, even if we're not the Wall Street Journal, or, you know, are we going to pay the money? And are we going to charge for our stuff, right?
Right.
And the answer is no for me on both. And I don't even have to think about it because I've already thought about it. When I started writing the precursor to Scripting News, which was called DaveNet, which were just sort of, it's just sort of like was an outburst. Mm-hmm. I know everybody thinks like I'm always outbursting and sort of angry or whatever, but I just, there was a whole, anyway, I don't want to divert into that. But
there was DaveNet and then there was blogging. I know that, yeah.
Pardon me? Yeah.
There was DaveNet and then there was blogging.
That's right. And when I first started doing that, Esther Dyson, who I'm sure you know, and probably a lot of our listeners do too, she had her newsletter, Release 1.0, and she just kept saying at me and about me to everybody that, look, this was just, he's just laying the groundwork. Sooner or later, he's going to start charging for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept saying, no, Esther, I am never going to charge for this.
Mm-hmm.
And my reason, and I knew it then and I'm still there, is that I didn't want anything to hold back the influence. I was writing to influence people. That was my purpose in doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So by putting a tariff on it, I would just reduce the amount of influence. It would work against everything that I was trying to do. I was trying to get a bunch of new ideas out there, getting people to listen to me. The whole idea of charging for it was antithetical to what I was doing. Now, in terms of why I have never paid for the Wall Street Journal and never will pay for the Wall Street Journal is because I can't point to anything I read there, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know this would just drive enormous frustration for me, is reading anything that I can't point to drives me crazy. It's one of the things, one of the reasons I don't like reading the Kindle.
Right.
Because I don't have a mechanism on the Kindle. If they put a button on there that said, tweet this, okay, I think I'd spend an infinitely larger amount of time reading the Kindle. To me, not being able to pass on a link to something that I'm reading makes the whole reading process almost pointless for me.
That's because you're thinking about it as a blogger, Dave.
I am a blogger. I think about it as a blogger.
Yeah, but what a blogger does is say, wait a minute, if I can't share that and spread that, it has less value to me.
No point in doing it, actually. It's so essential to what I do. Now, in terms of whether or not I'm interested in this, I'm not particularly interested in it because something came to me today. It was sort of an epiphany. And it takes me back to something that I asked the New York Times to do in the year 2002. I'm pretty sure it was 2002. And I asked them basically to offer blogs hosted on NewYorkTimes.com
to anyone who was quoted in the New York Times.
That's correct. And the whole point of that was to try to get the New York Times to include stuff that wasn't written by New York Times reporters in the New York Times itself, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they never went for it. And my feeling is that this is what we're waiting for, okay? That the New York Times can get themselves out of trouble in an instant by simply opening up the pipe and starting to accept content that does not come from their own internal hierarchy. And it came to me because I was trying to get to the heart of what bothered me about this whole 100 tweets thing. This goes back now to what you asked me, said we would talk about. I've been reading the tweets of the 100 most popular people on Twitter, and it's opened my mind. I'm saying, these guys are all wet blankets. None of them are doing anything interesting with this grand opportunity that they've got. What if the New York Times decided, now they say that there's no value to this, right? They say, oh, well, we didn't receive a gift because there's no value to it. Great, if there's no value, then stop pushing only New York Times links through that channel and start pushing links to everything. Start becoming a curator in New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Start finding us, become instead of a disc jockey, a DJ, become a TJ, a Twitter guy.
So you say they should take their huge number of followers
and decide
they're going to make a curated feed, which is not just New York Times, although they could certainly mix in a lot of New York Times, with other stuff that they're finding so that they're promoting the wider web and the wider world.
Right.
That's what you're saying, huh?
Jay, what would happen if they did this? What would happen? No, I'm not talking about what would happen in our world. What would happen in their world? What would happen inside the newsroom at the New York Times? Would they walk out, do you think? This is exactly what they need to go through and get out of their goddamn system. This is what's holding them back.
Mm-hmm.
Is the fact that this, and I'll tell you where this comes from. You know, this goes back way, way back. And this is something I wrote about in 2000 after coming back from Davos. Everybody was asking me, how do we make money on the Internet? What's the Internet about? Blah, blah, blah. So I had a chance to answer this question for a lot of people. And here's what I came up with, is that at the same time that our thirst for information is going through the roof, right? And that's something that people have not really paid a whole lot of attention to, but people use a lot more information today than they did 10 years ago.
Oh, totally,
we expect a lot more.
Yeah,
and while this is going on, the newspapers are shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fundamental problem. The New York Times needed to grow, and instead it shrank. And so that's their problem. That's why
Let's go back to charging. So if you say you don't want to pay, I understand why. You don't want to charge, I understand that too. I'm basically in the same position on that. In fact, anybody whose primary concern is with reputational goods will find that they don't want to charge, or they want to have a huge portion of what they're doing free, because there's almost like there's a tax on you if you charge. You can say, well, we'll pay that tax, but you still have to pay it, right? So to me, it's partly a strategic question, but it's also related to the question of value. And so when anybody says to me, we should charge for this, I always think it's kind of a strange
thing in the first place. It's nonsense, Jay. Let's get real about this.
It's not up to you exactly whether you charge. It's up to people who pay and whether you're making something that they would pay.
Thank you so much for including us. Thank you for including us in your thinking. All right. It's our money you're talking about.
Right. Thank you for reckoning with the host.
The problem is this. I'll tell you what the problem is. I'm sort of figuring things out at a very rapid rate right now. I'm just going back to things that I had already figured out that I forgot that I figured out. The thing is that what they used to charge for isn't the stories. They didn't used to charge for that. They charged for the fact that news was expensive to distribute. That was what cost money. Mm-hmm. And now that doesn't cost any money. So now they're stuck with the fundamental problem is that news doesn't cost any money.
That's why I think the only people who are serious about charging are those who are trying to create new products and new value. And that they could possibly charge for.
I don't see it. Honestly, don't see it. I think the sources are still where the value is where that's where the money is. If you're going to find a way to pay the sources, now I'm interested, okay? But if all you're doing is paying the guys who write the articles, I would rather read what the sources have to say in their own words. Because that's not diluted, and that is, you know, you're not playing the telephone game, and you don't end up with these guys have all these axes to grind. Can you see that? I mean, you know, the crap that I'm getting from the people at the Times on a daily basis, they're just showing me what their axes are, you know, the things that they don't want to talk about, because that's what they're angry at me for, right?
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about Ted Nelson?
Okay, you want to get me off all this stuff?
I definitely do, completely.
You do? Yes. Why are you thinking this? Okay.
For our own good, for your good. Because
why
you're not at your best when you're complaining about the New York Times, and neither am I. I want to hear about Ted Nelson.
Okay, thanks. I'm not sure. Because I think that this is what the people who listen to our podcast, why they're listening to it, is because I think in their gut they know that there's a problem here. And they're thinking that one day you and I are actually going to start talking about it, okay? Right? Instead of just tiptoeing around it and sort of like sidestepping the issue every time it comes up. But sure, I'll be happy to talk about Ted Nelson. But I remember where I was when I first read Ted Nelson stuff, and it gives me goosebumps every time I think about it. Because
what year?
This was 1979, and I was in Dallas, Texas, visiting, it might have been 80, but it was probably 79, and I was visiting a friend of mine who I was going to start a company with, and eventually did start a company with, and he had a copy of this book from Ted Nelson. It's this big sort of like tabloid-sized book, the same size as the Whole Earth Catalog, and it was itself hypertext. It was really this bizarre thing to read, but I couldn't put it down, and the reason I couldn't put it down was that this guy was tying together all the loose ends, all the things that were loose ends in my head, this intuition that I had that computers were not what everybody thought they were. They weren't, like, you know, counting systems is what computers were used for in the 70s
mm-hmm.
up to that point. And if you thought that a computer could be used for any purpose other than that, and launching spaceships, it was good for
mm-hmm.
that, too, that if you thought it could be used for anything other than that, you were like, come on, you're doing drugs again. Time for you to relax a little bit, because it's not about that. And I was saying, you know, I'm sure that this is really going to amount that sooner, someday programmers are going to be seen as very creative people, and, you know, and that these things are going to be used as tools to create democracy, that this is going to be a mechanism. And that's everything what Nelson was saying. That's what Nelson was saying in his book. And he was citing all these examples of work that had been done by people who believed this going back to the 1930s. And most of the people that, I mean, you'd find people here and there, you know, at the universities. I was at the University of Wisconsin. Here and there, people that sort of had an inkling that this is the way it was going to go, but nobody tied it all together until Nelson wrote the book. And that book was the anthem for the people who developed the software, the systems, it was the thing that you could say, have you read Nelson's book? And everybody, the people who said yes and I loved it, those are people you could work with.
Mm-hmm.
And so it truly was an inspiration for
it. So wait a second, stop for a second. So did this book change your concept of yourself and what you were doing?
No. No, it gave me confidence, though, because I already knew that this was where I was going. And in fact, I'm going to do this at another time. I don't want to go too deep into this, but a lot of the stuff was in there about a guy named Doug Engelbart, who had worked on exactly the same stuff that I was already working on. I was working on what we called outliners. And Engelbart, one of the many things that he worked on, he also did the mouse and the first windowing systems. I mean, he invented a lot of the stuff that is now sort of like deeply ingrained in what the computers are. But he also wrote about his own hypertext systems. And people started, you know, when I wrote about this the other day on Scripting News, people started saying, well, you need to give him credit for hypertext. Of course I do. But that wasn't the inspiration. And, you know, and Nelson is kind of a gadfly and kind of has some whacked out ideas about hypertext.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't turn out to be the way hypertext worked. We are using hypertext all over the place, and I actually thought Nelson was wrong about it, and it didn't turn out the way he said it was going to turn out. So I'm not going to say he was an inspiration for the hypertext. You'd have to ask Tim Berners-Lee that, whether it was an inspiration for him or not. I don't think it was.
What was his argument about computers? What was it that he saw about computers differently?
That they were humanistic, that they were for humanity, that they were literary tools, that it was a way of expressing, you know, poetic ideas, that you could be inspired. The whole idea that computers themselves could inspire human beings, you know, that they were really reflections of ourselves, you know, that they mirrored something that existed inside of, that they were part of humanity. I mean, the assumption was that computers were, and you see this in science fiction all over the place, that computers were not humanity, you know. That was Isaac Asimov's stories, you know. But in fact, computers are part of humanity. They reflect part of who we are, because guess who designed them, right?
1964, so, Marshall McLuhan publishes Understanding Media. The subtitle of it is The Extensions of Man.
Mm-hmm.
Media are extensions of us.
Extensions. That's right.
And what you're saying is that's how Nelson viewed the computer.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that was the theory. That was sort of that was the thesis for the people that were inspired by Nelson's book.
Yeah. All right. So how do we extend Nelson into rebooting the news?
That's a really good question.
That's what we get paid for in the university, Dave.
Well, since you get paid for that in the university, what's the answer?
You got to earn your keep here, Jay. Yeah. The whole idea of news, the whole idea of improving the news has nothing to do with keeping journalists. employed, even though it might be very important to have journalists employed for the news to exist. But the whole idea of the news and spreading the news is to include more of humanity in the public conversation, in the political conversation, and in a share not only of power, but of reason about that power, of deciding what to do. And the whole reason we care about the press at all is that we want to include more of the human community, more of the political community, in knowing how things work.
I think that I agree with you 100%, 1,000,000%.
There we go. So that project continued.
Obviously. Okay. You did answer the question. You nailed it. Because, you know, without that understanding that the computer and, by extension, the networks, because Nelson also talked about that, that really the computer isn't where it's all happening.
Go back then and explain what. Explain the part about the connection between computers and networks and what a network meant at that time, because this was early in the development of the network.
The network meant the same thing that it means today. There's no difference. My first experience in computer networks was the ability to write programs that exist independent of a single computer, where you might run a copy of the program on your computer and I might run a copy on my computer, and we then are able to, as human beings, communicate because we have two pieces of software that understand each other.
Right.
How to communicate with each other. That, by extension, means that you and I, as human beings, can now communicate with each other.
Right.
And the next thing that happens is that now I make a piece of software, and Joe down the street makes a piece of software, and they're written in different languages, and they run on different, you know, architectures, computer architectures. Doesn't matter. We still can communicate because of standards, because we have agreed on how our computers will communicate with each other.
So what's a network?
What's a network? A network is the hardware, the computer hardware, that facilitates communication between human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that cunt, or does that make sense? I mean, I don't know that there's...
No, your story makes sense. You go on with it.
I have to go on. I think I'm done.
Okay. All right, so the network was the network, and he talked about the potential of networks?
Yeah, but it's all part of this whole picture of
human
beings. You know, it's because I don't think that even at that point we're finished, because it's not the network that matters. It's the human beings that are on the network that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's there we're now at the exact same place that you're at, which is the news in this. You and I agree, and we find we have stuff to talk about because we're talking about the same thing. You know, I love the news, always have. I mean, and that goes back to, you know, very early life. And when I started using computers, it was almost immediately because of the sense that they were part of this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it's also true that I think that I don't believe in priesthoods. And that was another thing, by the way, that Nelson talked about a lot, was the priesthood in the computer business,
mm-hmm.
and about how they control their whole, and this is a recurring theme, by the way, that there are cycles to the computer business, and it's always a struggle between the industry that wants to control the communication, and that has happened over and over and over again. Okay, and the users who eventually realize this is what the industry is doing, and they break out of the control.
Mm-hmm.
But then they fall back under control, and they break out, and they fall back.
So we're in a period where the users of journalism are breaking out, and then they come back under control. Makes sense.
Yep.
Okay. Let's move on.
Okay, sure.
Well, what else do you want to talk about?
Well, what do you want to talk about?
I really feel like I've, like, dominated this one so far, and I don't like to do that. So it's, I don't want to do that. So it's, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I've been trying to...
Well, wait a second. Do you want to talk about that argument that you've been having?
No, not at all.
Okay, good.
I want to talk about the idea of a rebooted system for news and a particular part of it that I've been trying to rethink with a bunch of other people who are hip to the same context, and I want to share it with our listeners so that more people are thinking about it. And it goes back to something that I know you've heard, which is the great NPR This American Life program, The Giant Pool of Money, which is a award-winning hour of radio that explains the mortgage crisis in a really miraculous way.
What
many
award
people,
did it win?
It won the DuPont Award for Excellence in Broadcasting and a bunch of other things as well.
It was truly excellent.
Yeah, and I call it the greatest work of explanatory journalism ever heard, which I do believe it is. At least that I've ever heard.
And it was totally needed at that time as well.
Yes, yeah. Completely so.
Yeah.
And my wife actually is the one who bugged me to listen to this. And on a car trip, I finally did, and I actually listened to it twice in a row because it was so amazing. But it made me really think about a particular part of any rebooted system for news. And it came to me after I realized that once I heard this program that explained mortgage-backed securities and the whole mortgage crisis, which became the banking crisis, which became the economic crisis, I started to read the news again about those things. Whereas before, I experienced the news as this buzzing or blinking red light that I knew was a big story, but I didn't understand the story, so I didn't read any of the news. I didn't want to because I knew that I was going to get lost in a jumble of terms. I didn't know that I would end up kind of frustrated that I sensed it was important but didn't grasp why. And so I had basically pushed the story away, hoping other people were, you know, monitoring it. But after listening, this amazing explanation from the ground up of this incredible scam, I started paying attention to news. So this made me think, well, it's kind of the reverse of the way that journalists and journalism professors model the transaction, because in the way you normally think about news, the news alerts you, you learn a little bit about, oh, there's a problem with mortgage-backed securities, you follow the news and it's kind of explained, you read the updates and then you read the Saturday analysis piece and you come to some sort of general understanding of the issue. But here it was different because unless you had the whole narrative of the scandal, you didn't care about any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You needed the whole to appreciate the parts. And so it had this, so it started me thinking that if the news system was better at creating these explainers, superior performance explanation, as with This American Life and The Giant Pool of Money, would be a demand generator for news. Because once people understand, they follow the updates.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get it, they want to know what happened, right? And if they became better as explainers, they would have a much more attentive and appreciative audience for the updates, for the news. And this whole relationship between explanation and information had been misunderstood. It was actually explanation of a really high-quality kind that leads us into information.
Well, what was the misunderstanding?
The misunderstanding is that that just by accumulation of updates, you will get the story.
I see.
In fact,
sort of almost by osmosis.
Yeah, right.
If we have enough sort of yin and yang you know, give
yeah, us we have, you know, a lot of news, fractured, scattered news stories,
right,
and a couple of columnists sort of do it, right?
Right.
But they don't. And what happens is that when we don't have a narrative grasp, when we don't understand the whole,
the
updates not only don't inform us, they alienate us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was, I had a similar experience today reading Frank Rich's column in the New York Times, where the first half of it, I was like going, yeah. You know, I was like, man, this guy's really, he's going to do it now. He's really going to explain the crisis in the news industry. And then he drifted off and became the same coverage that we've been getting all along. You know, that seems to me to be another story that needs that kind of treatment, that needs the This American Life view of it, that says dispassionately, this is actually what's going on here, as opposed to what we're getting, which is, you know, they don't want to cover this story, you know.
A giant pool of money, one-hour explainer about the crisis of the news industry would be great. I didn't read Frank Rich's piece the way you did. I read something different.
What did you read?
Well, I felt that he had discovered a new voice and entered the discussion of the future of news, a new kind of argument where he said, not here is the business model, or here is what would save the industry, or here's who's right, the new media people, the traditional people, or Walter Isaacson, but none of that really matters. It's actually the public's choice from here on what kind of journalism we get.
Mm.
And if you look at it that way first, primarily the public's choice, and the arguments that these journalists are having with these other people over here aren't really fundamental to it. And we have to see what the public does. I think that's a different idea. It's not a curmudgeon's idea. It's not Edgar's idea, you know?
Right.
And if you look at the piece carefully, you'll see that he avoids saying, I disagree that citizen journalists can replace the news media. He avoids saying those freeloaders are getting it for free. He avoids every curmudgeon impulse there is and comes back around to, well, what does the public want? And I think that's a good question.
I think the public wants itself. I think the public wants to be in. I think the
mm-hmm.
public wants to be part of this. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think we're waiting for them. I know we shouldn't be talking about the New York Times all the time, but they really are the emblem, you know. Whoever, let's just say X, all right? That industry needs to get that they need to open their doors. That,
you know,
opening their doors is the thing that we're waiting for.
What's so funny about it is that everybody who loves news loves it because it's a way of participating. You know?
But our form of participating is very limited. And even public radio, which calls itself the public and advertises itself as being, you know, this is your... You own this. I've heard that over and over and over again.
Yeah, sure. They
still, our ownership, our involvement is to the extent of, well, we're allowed to give them money, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thank you. I do, but, you know, I want to be more involved. It was sort of like the same thing. This happened in computer networks, too, going back to the talking about networks. You know, do you remember CompuServe?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to write software that ran on CompuServe. And so I said to them, you know, I was a user of them, much the same way I'm a user of Twitter today, you know, is I want to run software in your cloud. We didn't call it a cloud, but that's what I was saying. And they didn't even respond because they didn't understand it. And then 10 years later, they're gone, and the Internet, the web is there, and, of course, it's all built out of people running all of our own software in that cloud. It's the same argument, basically. Is that, you know, you've got this system that is, weren't you saying earlier that this system is open? I'm not sure I understood what you were you saying that? Did I see you say that somewhere? That the new system is open?
No, I say open systems don't work the same way as closed systems. And I also say, in reference to your earlier observation, that Professional journalism was optimized for low participation by the users.
Right.
That is how it was constructed.
Correct.
And it was constructed also for high public service to the users, but that public service was a professional obligation. It had to do with what the professionals do.
And they get to decide what the public
And they get to decide
do.
And judge, and that's what the prize culture is about. But it was optimized for low participation.
Why was that? Why was it that way?
Well, it was functional for the kind of industry that it was. It was a manufacturing industry that had to reproduce the world every 24 hours in a reliable way and protect that product from undue influence.
Isn't that interesting? Reproduce the world was the mission.
Well,
that,
sort of.
That,
I mean, reproduce what's going on in Pittsburgh. Reproduce the complete...
Right. I know. I think that's a powerful statement. Is that something that, you journalism professors agree on, or is that a Jay Rosen thing, or is that...
That would be the way I would put it, and other people who try and think about journalism would put it. It might not be the same language, but they would have a comparable
same idea.
Language.
So now,
yeah.
Is that still the mission of journalism, I guess, is the question, to reproduce the world in some form or dot, dot, dot? Is it something else now?
Well, you could also say update us on the state of the world in Pittsburgh, in the Bay Area, right, in the United States. That's what news is. It's
but maybe at some point
it
is the world. Maybe it is the world. Maybe there's no reproducing the world.
Man, now we've got into freshman dorm territory, Dave.
What do you mean by that? You mean I've gone all this distance just to get back to the freshman dorm?
Yeah. I think we should wrap up.
You know, I'm 54 years old now. I just want you to know I'm not a freshman anymore, you know.
All right, let's wrap this up. It's been good. It's been a good
time. We have to wrap it up now. Okay. Well, because I ended up in the freshman dorm?
No. it's just a good way of reminding us of the seasons, the cycles of life.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry I talked so much this week, I guess.
Not at all. No.
Hope I didn't get you in too much trouble there, Jay. Let's get a disclaimer in here. Jay doesn't agree with anything I said and doesn't support it at all.
No, not at all. But there are always things you say that I would not endorse, and then there are others that I would
sure.
totally endorse, and, you know, it's a mix.
I endorse everything you say, by the way, just so you can feel bad tonight.
A full endorsement.
Yeah, no, without qualification, I endorse everything you say. So.
All right, well, this is Boudin the News number 9.
Yeah.
And we're starting to get somewhere. I particularly like sources of inspiration. I already have the person for next week, and he's younger than us.
That was, you know, before we go, that was something actually that I was thinking about this week. I put a lot of thought into deciding who this week's would be,
mm-hmm.
and I kept trying to think, is like, well, now Marshall is younger than we are, too. Right?
Yes, he is.
Okay. So it's that wouldn't be the first time that
no,
we had somebody younger. But I was, I'm reluctant at this point to honor somebody who's younger, because I think that first I have to deal with the elders that would have inspired me.
Right.
I think I need to do that because I think it's important to acknowledge them, that they've done some great stuff. So,
if you ever see an interview with a really, really mediocre band and you ask them, what are your influences?
Yeah.
Oh, we think we're originals. We have our own sound. But
no.
If you ask a really, really good band, what are your influences? They
yeah.
talk for, like, hours.
Yeah. You know, I was arguing with some guy said that RSS was dead, and this really got to me because what I wanted to say, and I did say this in a piece I wrote, is that, you know, in music they honor, you know, if you were asked the Rolling Stones, you know, what do you think of, you know, Chuck Berry or Muddy Waters, they go on, like you said, for hours and tell
mm-hmm.
you all the things these people did for them. That we really need to be doing that. We need to cherish and love. You don't ever call something that made a big difference. You don't ever say it's dead. It's
mm.
not. It's because mm. they never are. They're
right.
built into everything you do. The things that are you know, real inspirations, they're just there, you know. And it's very important.
And they go on.
I'm glad we agree on that, by the way.
As we go on.
Pardon me?
And they go on as we go on.
We hope. Not
yeah.
quiz. All right, Jay. As always, it's wonderful.
Good night, Dave. Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.